Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about the impeachment hearings that have been going on in the Senate, and they're expected on Tuesday to have a their cloture vote has already been submitted. So Tuesday they're expected to go nuclear, short of some last-minute deal. So we'll be talking in a moment to John Flannery. He's a former federal prosecutor. He's served as a special counsel to the United States Senate Judiciary Committee. He also was on the minority's legal team in the defense of William Jefferson Clinton in his impeachment trial. We'll also talk later with Gary Schroen, who served in the CIA for 35 years, and he has won a number of awards, the highest awards given by the CIA. He's the author of a new book, First In, an insider's account of how the CIA spearheaded the war on terror in Afghanistan. He was led the team that was sent into Afghanistan shortly after 9/11, and we're talking to him about current events vis-a-vis Afghanistan, with the Afghan leader Karzai visiting the White House on Monday, the torture story that has been broken by the New York Times, and of course the Newsweek story as well. And we'll also talk about the broader issues involving Iraq and the Middle East in general. I'm speaking with John Flannery. He's a former federal prosecutor. He served on the United States Senate as special counsel to the United States Senate Judiciary Committee, and also was on the legal team defending William Jefferson Clinton in his impeachment. And obviously, John will know on Tuesday whether this thing's going to go nuclear in the Senate.
Well, I think it's already gone nuclear. I don't really think they have any alternative.
Right.
What the phony argument here is whether or not there's a possibility of a compromise. And the only compromise that is possible from the White House's standpoint is one that says you will under no circumstances use a filibuster to block who we want to go on the Supreme Court when and as the opening occurs, whether it's Chief Justice Rehnquist or someone else. And I don't think there's any Democratic leader or member who's prepared to give a bye on that question. So I think the compromise has to go south unless it allows them to invoke the filibuster then, and that doesn't suit the White House, because the White House wants, in this somewhat less visible fight, to get a clear path for Scalia, probably, when that question arises down the road.
Yes, apparently Senator Leahy was at a White House event talking with Vice President Cheney when President Bush came by, and he tried to sort of collar him and ask him about whether the president could break the deadlock. And it was clear that President Bush did not want to get involved, because he essentially has picked this fight. It seems to me that nobody seems to recognize this in the media. I can't understand why. These people have been rejected any number of times, and he was poking them in the eye by sending them back again, having had 95% of his people approved at any rate. So this is a fight that clearly the president wanted.
Now, the president wants this fight, and he realizes he can't win without changing the rules. And this is a president that loves changing the rules, whether he's running for president in 2000 or whether it's the Schiavo case, or you just name it. Now, look at how they handled DeLay, one of his fundraisers, a majority leader on the House side. I mean, there is almost nothing unethical this guy can do that anybody finds reprehensible enough, because he brings home the bacon, and I mean money, campaign money, and redistricting in Texas. And so they rewrite the rules on ethics for DeLay. They rewrite the rules on elections using the Supreme Court. They rewrite their own theory of government when it comes to the Schiavo case. And so why should it surprise us that when it comes to how they're going to put whom they want in charge of the Supreme Court, that they ramp up this fight on the filibuster to clear out the underbrush so they can put Scalia in as chief judge when the opportunity arises?
And there's also a likelihood of an opportunity of two more seats with Justice Stevens and O'Connor expected to retire.
There's no question that the Supreme Court is at a tipping point, if you will, a point of flux. Now, these members of the Supreme Court, although challenged with illness and age and so forth, have proven themselves to be quite resilient. But there is no question either in this president's term or whomever the next president is, whether it's Hillary Clinton or someone else, is going to have to confront the composition of the Supreme Court. And that's what this fight is about, writing the law and whether or not we have individual rights and liberties for the next 10, 20, or 50 years, and what those what the circumference of those rights is are.
Well, John Flannery, no, I think that actually it is very much about the Supreme Court and not about these handful of rather extreme judges that are so incendiary that to invite this showdown. I don't think that that President Bush will make will use the same tactic in choosing replacements for a replacement for Rehnquist doesn't change the balance, but a replacement for O'Connor or Stevens will.
Well, that's true, but it's very interesting how they've taken a no prisoners approach. Of all the judges they could bring up for the first fight in this ramping up to change the rules so they can choose the Supreme Court, they choose Justice Priscilla Owen, herself an extremist, a person disapproved when he was on the court, the Texas court, by the current Attorney General appointed by President Bush. They bring a person in who very strongly ideological. Now, if you flash back to the presidential campaign, not that this should surprise us that people change their minds, right? But we had President Bush say in debates, I have no litmus test for anyone who goes on the bench. And then Priscilla Owen is the first one out of the block, and this is the one they circle the fight about. So why do they choose somebody so radical for this fight? Because they're always building their base. Democrats, borrow a page from this, will you? They're always building their base. Justice Owen is an extremist, an ideologue, a Christian rightist, and she wants to ignore the law, and that's who they want to put on the bench, called a judicial activist by no less than the current Attorney General. Now, the Democrats, they just don't come to this table to war, and they're in danger of losing this fight by failing to come into the arena and actually engage on the issues that matter. Why is Leahy pretending that this compromise means anything? It doesn't. There is going to be no compromise. We should be talking about the issues that really matter and how these guys are trying to steal from us our individual rights and liberties, but we're not.
And it seems that the debate, if anybody who watched it on C-SPAN, it's outrageous the hubris with which the Republicans play with the truth. I mean, it's as though the old adage that if you repeat a lie long enough, it becomes the truth. But I mean, some of those people, particularly these kind of people who want the Christian Sharia, like Coburn and Brownback and Santorum, are. I mean, what they say is borders on the absurd. A couple of the Democratic senators, one of whom is leaving the Senate, Mark Dayton, took them on and spoke plainly about that this was a push by neo-theocons.
Well, yeah.
And that it's all about the ambitions of Frist and et cetera, and it's all being run by the White House, as we know. But again, it seems to me that we ought to look down the path a little bit about what the real intentions are here. And it seems to me that at the end of the day, this is about Roe v. Wade, isn't it?
It's about Roe v. Wade, but, you know, it's a much broader agenda than that. The Karl Rove agenda, because that is the engineer in the White House for much of this. The Karl Rove agenda is to dismantle everything that was the New Deal, any contribution that was Democrat, branded as Republican, and to shift toward the right, toward a theocratic regime.
And a permanent Republican government.
And a permanent Republican government. I mean, if you watch the Republican Party at the local level, if the local League of Women Voters tends Democratic in their view, they try to get members to take it all over. if you look at what they're doing here, they don't want anybody to mass 40 people who say, we feel so strongly about a justice, they shouldn't be on the court. They want to eliminate that possible dissent, and it goes on and on. Each and every initiative that is processed is to make it unfair, which is to say to make it outcome determinative so they can do whatever they want. And why? Because we can, because we have the power. Now, the last echo of this kind of government, probably, that we acknowledge existed was when Nixon was in power. And then we had a lot of talk, a lot of bipartisan talk, which I believe was genuine, about this was a government of laws, not of men. Well, these guys have gone right back to the worst evils of the Nixon administration, and they have become a government of power and of themselves and not of laws. You look at how they gerrymander Texas, you look at the ethics violations, even the candidate they have up who was on the Supreme Court in Texas, her campaign was engineered by Karl Rove. This lady took contributions from corporations. She took it from a variety of people, and then she sat in conflict situations on cases that came before the court. How is that different from Justice Scalia going out duck hunting with the Vice President of the United States? The interesting thing is we can take Karl Rove and this justice and Karl Rove and the Vice President, and on Tuesday, if we do have the nuclear option, the Vice President of the United States will say that a 60-vote requirement is out of order for cloture and that it should be a majority vote. The Vice President, the friend of Scalia, and more than that, the political ally, in my opinion, and Karl Rove, the architect in the White House, and Priscilla Owen, the nominee who's going to be on the floor of the Senate, all come together in one outstanding, revolutionary, and bad-minded decision.
Well, couldn't you call it a push?
It's an enormous push, yeah.
P-U-T-C.
A push, I'm sorry.
I'm talking about the German word, push.
Yes, but exactly.
Yeah. Well, again, it seems that the brazen disregard for the truth is breathtaking, and I'm surprised that, you know, a few people try to call them up on it, but I'm just surprised that that there's not more checks and fact-checking here in the press about the outrageous claims. The most obvious one being that there is a long-standing Senate rule that you need a two-thirds majority to change a rule. They are arbitrarily changing it using the vice president. Of course, once they change this rule and get away with it, every Senate rule would then be changed. There's no reason to restrict this just to judicial nominations. It'll also apply to cabinet members, etc. So the Senate will be essentially gelded.
Well, and you may see the rule changed as to stem cell research and overturning vetoes and all sorts of, well, there are some rules that are written right into the Constitution, but I do fear that you will see them writing rules if they can get away with it. And, you know, you mentioned the media not commenting on it. There appears to be no outrage by public or media. I mean, when we went through the presidential campaign, and I'm a genetic Democrat, whether it was Senator Kerry or President Bush who made a misstatement or an error, it was forgiven. We teach children one thing, and we allow candidates to say things that are most astonishing, but they're never held accountable for it. It just washes through, and we don't seem to care that they get it wrong. The biggest lie, I suppose, was we're looking for weapons of mass destruction. Some people have compared it to the Social Security battle as well.
Well, I'm sorry, we just lost your volume there for a second. Are you with us still?
I'm still here.
Thank you.
Well, I'm still here electronically.
Okay.
Speaking, yes.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with John Flannery. He's a former federal prosecutor, and he was a special counsel to the United States Senate Judiciary Committee. He's also served on the legal team defending President William Jefferson Clinton against his impeachment.
Well, when you say the legal team, I was counsel, one of the judiciary counsel during the impeachment, and it is absolutely safe to say that our view was we should have a fair process in place, and the Republicans were afraid a fair process would have defeated their efforts to impeach him in the House as they did in December 18th, 1998. And in that case, the Senate's calm, if you will, and fair appraisal of the situation saved us from another constitutional disaster.
Well, that was a particularly extraordinary affair, given how penny ante his transgressions were compared to taking a country to war based on lies that you manufacture. And you, the President of the United States, still can't explain to the American people what the hell this war's about. You keep changing your mind. One minute it's weapons of mass destruction, then it's to bring democracy, then it's to get rid of tyrants. You know, mm-hmm. You know, normally war is thrust upon you, but if you decide to go to war, an optional war, one that's not necessary, then you should be doubly culpable. But again, even after the British, the leak of the British document that proves that this White House cooked this whole war up out of whole cloth, still, there was some outrage in England. It affected Tony Blair.
Well, it sure did. But
what the hell's going on here? Why is there's no more outrage left in the public?
I think that the public has decided the government is something they have to work on, and that it's arrogant and doesn't represent them. And so, for the most part, people are more concerned about their survival, and they don't think that the government is the answer to their problems. I mean, if you look at the Republican regimes in recent years, Reagan, who is heralded as one of the great presidents we had, presided over Iran-Contra. And other people might question how it was that on the day of the inauguration, somehow or other, he managed to obtain a settlement in the hostage situation that escaped Mr. Carter all during his efforts for re-election.
The October surprise, right?
Yeah, well, now we have another president who is literally holding hands with the Saudis and ignoring North Korean nuclear threats, and we're entangled in a mess in Iraq, and Afghanistan is falling apart, and we can't find Osama bin Laden. Why? Maybe because this administration doesn't want to. I don't know. And
we'll be talking about that with the CIA fellow that's following you.
Oh yeah,
Gary Schron, because there's some evidence that the Pakistanis don't want to capture him.
Well,
if they ever do, he'll be dead. That's
well,
for
your
sure.
Next guest has written a fabulous book.
Yeah, so I was going to follow up on that, but you know, Seymour Hersh recently was quoted as saying that these people, meaning the White House, are total zealots, including the president in particular. Right. And the scary part is that they think they know what they're doing, and their foreign policy guru is this ridiculous academic who is just so pedantic and has so little real world experience, Condoleezza Rice. It's the blind leading the blind. I mean, it's really, and yet people think that they actually know what they're doing. The problem being here is that a huge core support for this president is the theocratic 40% of this country, in the red states in particular. And you know, if the Lord has delivered you, then none of this stuff matters. You don't, you know, the big questions are taken care of once you are born again, as the president is. So none of this stuff matters. Truth, reality. The same thing applies to bin Laden's people, that you simply can't reach these people.
Well, what you've outlined is really, we have in the White House Crusader Rabbit, who believes he's fighting the new crusade in a theocratic regime. Luckily, one of the educations we had during the Shivo mess was that people are not quite as simple as the strategy is, which is... they thought by invoking Shaivo and saying this is all about right to life and religion and things like that, the people would just walk behind them. But there was an overwhelming reaction that you should stay out of such family decisions, as how we conclude our lives and who and how in our family makes these decisions. And we're happier with what the state courts have been doing going back for years and years. So the public is not so conforming to this... self-righteous, right-wing Christian crusade that takes us into the Middle East. And I think they're frankly tiring of the billions of dollars that we're spending and intend to spend in an affair that doesn't seem to be resolving itself well and is putting us at risk elsewhere in the world in terms of our foreign relations.
Well, indeed, it was encouraging to see when the president spoke yesterday at a commencement address at a Christian college in Michigan, that a number of the students were demonstrating, and many of them wore a badge saying that God is not a Republican or a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps there is some kind of backlash. But The president's only veto is now being threatened over stem cells. I mean, when people say that he is carrying the water for the religious right, I think that's hardly adequate. He is the religious right. If you watch so-called Christian television, right. President Bush is their de facto leader, and I think he is quite comfortable in that role.
Well, I think he is. He plays it a little more carefully than Frist has, which is...
Well, he's cravenly sucking up to that wacko Dobson, you know. I mean,
cravenly sucking up. I think that's a classic line.
Well, it just shows you how pathetic it's become that, you know, that these mercantile shakedown snake oil televangelists are... You know, and not only are they being taken seriously, they consider themselves the power brokers in the new America.
Well, they do, and there's no longer any room in the Republican Party for moderates, which is a very sad thing, because that's been the pathway in both parties to figure out what we can compromise on so we can govern. And increasingly, this has become one long, distorted political campaign in both parties, so we come to impasse. And commentators and observers of the political process who care about it say the House and the Senate have become irrelevant to our lives because they don't dare pass anything that's meaningful because they're so busy making sound bites to impress us so they get reelected to their phony baloney jobs. And it's high time in this country that we had people who actually represented us who were trying to address the difficult problems, whether it is how we extricate or maintain the situation in Iraq, how we deal with North Korea, what do we do with Social Security, what is the proper bright line to be tolerant of religions and respect them at the same time. This administration has no interest in it. You know, Jefferson said it at the beginning, a nation that expects to be ignorant and free expects what never was and never will be. And this administration favors an ignorant nation because it is the only way it can govern.
Well, if we didn't have such a feckless opposition and such phony politesse in our political debate, I mean, an example of that that exposed the fatuousness and the constipated nature of our political lack of a political debate was George Galloway absolutely reaming Senator Coleman at these hearings. You know, you don't have to agree with Galloway to recognize that this is, you know, politics in the rest of the Democratic world is a contact sport. Here, if you watch the news hour on PBS, I respectfully disagree with my learned colleague. I think that this is why people have given up on these politicians, apart from the fact that you mentioned that most of the people that go to Washington represent capital and not people. Nevertheless, you know, they don't. Nobody seems to have any conviction, any passion. You know, they're all sort of gray, waffling compromisers. And it was so refreshing to actually hear somebody with strong opinions. And it was clear that that Coleman simply was hit by a bus.
Well, I'm a big fan of watching how Parliament does its business, because the debate is lively and to the point.
Well, but also, John, in journalism, I was trained at the BBC. Yes. You know, your standard question to a politician is, last week you said X, this week you said Y. Were you lying last week or are you lying this week? You know, if only we had those kind of questions to these small town lawyers, you know, with their Christian homilies.
Well, yesterday I had a conversation, I should say a discussion about this same filibustering issue with a guy named Chris Hennig, the former deputy assistant to President Bush. And he was point blank asked, isn't this filibustering all about the Supreme Court? And he ignored the question, and the host got so upset, he chased him around the room until he...
That was on Fox, I saw that.
On Fox News, and he forced him to answer, and a couple of my friends said, I thought that was you, and I said, no. I said, I guess fair and balanced does sometime apply.
Well, let me just, in the last few minutes, John Flannery, run by, tie some of these strings up here that we've sort of been weaving our way through this filibuster story. I think that at the end of the road here is a real intention take on Roe v. Wade.
Right, absolutely.
There's a very good book by Thomas Frank called What's the Matter with Kansas that's gotten a lot of attention. The central thesis of it is that why do people vote against their interests and get beguiled by these televangelists?
Right.
One of the things that he argues is that the corporatists who control the Republican Party, the corporatists use these religious people, whip them up in the fervor, get them to go out and win elections, but at the end of the day, they don't want to really overturn Roe v. Wade because they need that engine to keep these people percolating with anger. Now, I think that's a wrong reading of what happened. I don't think these people have been crusading for 35 years not to win, and I think Bush totally is on their side. They're laying the groundwork, but if they get rid of the filibuster, it's largely to prepare them for the Supreme Court nominees. Apparently, there are two nominees from Virginia that are likely to come up. I think one of them is Wilkinson. I can't remember the other guy's name. You might know them.
I'm blocking on his name, but he was one of the people who espoused the policy on torture.
Right.
And he's
not Bybee.
Huh?
Not Bybee.
No.
Bobby got promoted to appeals court as a result of after having written that torture memo.
Yes. Well, we try to keep straight the misconduct, but
right. You
can pretty safely say on the torture thing outside of the counsel for the Secretary of State, Mr. Taft, that almost the entire administration thought torture was fine.
Right.
But the way I think I would tie it together, I think you're absolutely right. This is a rightist agenda, and it does have to do with overturning specific Supreme Court decisions with Roe v. Wade at the top of the list.
Right, and I don't think they'll take it on frontally. Won't they kick it back to the states and use this recently passed law as a test case that you can't cross state lines or...
You have more faith than I do. After what I saw in the 2000 election with Judge Rehnquist basically overturning, denying the opportunity to find out what the state voters wanted in Florida,
right.
I could believe that the law could go 180 degrees on any case, and you'd read the language and wonder how they got there, and they would have gotten there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you're trying to handicap what's going on the nuclear option, all you have to, if you see a Frist back off, it doesn't mean he believes in compromise. It means that among his members, there are Republicans that say this is too far. As extreme right as the Republican Party has been, there are men of conscience in the Senate. And there are more than McKay and
McCain, right?
McCain and several others who have been identified. And the question is, when push comes to shove, will they say, "Look, if you go forward with this Frist, I'm going to have to vote against it"? And it would be tantamount to another chapter in Jack Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. If he does go forward, it means he has the votes, and I think it's a very sorry chapter in American history. Then we'll get to see if the Democrats will have the nerve to do the equivalent in labor movements of what they call work to rule, meaning we will enforce every rule that the Senate has. Instead of unanimous consent for this or that happening, we will demand that you rely upon the rules and you follow them. And it may open up tests on filibuster involving the stem cell question and other things. So
there are a few more wobbly Republicans on the stem cell issue, I think, aren't there?
I think there are. And when you say wobbly, I would rather characterize them as people that who want to represent their constituents and not deny them, or if not them, their children or grandchildren, a possible remedy to diabetes and cancer and every manner of research that stem cell research suggests by its very existence.
But there is also this White House that basically wants them to be a rubber stamp, and
right.
you get Karl Rove on the phone powering down on you. apparently most of them buckle under. And
well, do you want an opponent in your next primary? Do you want the pork barrel issues for your group denied? Do you want to lose your position on this or that committee? Ask Senator Spector. Yeah. Senator Spector came on saying that he was a little concerned about Roe v. Wade, and boy, they woodshedded him quicker than you could imagine.
Right.
And he had to basically sign an agreement and agree to an overlord before he could become the chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
Well, just in closing, John Flannery, what do you think it'll take to wake up the people to the real agenda behind this filibuster, the fact that they are going to change this country if they can get away with it? They're planning on doing it. I mean, I don't know. All this insanity about judicial activism vis-a-vis Roe v. Wade, I mean, it's the same crazy thing they did during the during the Depression with prohibition. You know, you legislate morality, you end up with really crazy social consequences. And in the case of prohibition, it ended up being the impetus for organized crime. The reason that they overturned Roe v. Wade was that there was a real social problem where people were dying from backroom abortions. So, are we going to go back to that? Is anybody talking about what of the insanity of trying to legislate morality?
I think that some people have to experience the worst outcome before it moves the political mass. I don't know that we're going to have to go through that to have people say enough is enough, we're not going to deal with this anymore, and swing the pendulum another direction. But I do think that what is delaying the swing of the pendulum is that in this cultural war, in this war of foreign policy, in this war of domestic hurt, Democrats cannot remain silent and expect the pendulum to shift. And so it has become, to borrow from our Christian friends in the New Testament, Christ said, if you are neutral, I'll spit you forth from my mouth. And that is one clarion call that all politicians should have, to actually speak their minds and their conscience. And Democrats have to say that. And unfortunately, the more quiet they are, the more pain the public has to have before they take their destiny in their own hands. Right now, I think we're failing the nation through our political institutions because we're remaining too silent in the face of these outrages, and so we are not leading. We are hoping, quote, they are going to get it. Well, that's a wrong approach. That's dishonest. That's not up to the standard. And people shouldn't be rewarded by being elected because the Republicans default in some way. And we as Democrats or the loyal opposition or the independents give voice to how we believe the country should be, we're going to suffer these outrages.
Without vision, you perish.
Exactly.
I thank you for joining us, John Flannery.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with John Flannery. He's a former federal prosecutor. He served as a special counsel to the United States Senate Judiciary Committee. He also served on the House Judiciary Committee on the Minority in the impeachment of President William Jefferson Clinton. I'm now speaking with Gary Schoen, who served in the CIA for 35 years, mostly in the Middle East, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. His honors include the Intelligence Cross, the highest award given by the CIA, and he's the author of a fascinating new book, First In, an insider's account of how the CIA spearheaded the war on terror in Afghanistan. And Gary, this week there's been a number of stories about Afghanistan, of course, starting with the riots following the Newsweek articles, and then the New York Times revelations, for, I guess, a leak of an internal army document on the death of a couple of prisoners at Bagram, and I imagine that will all be on the agenda Monday when President Karzai meets with President Bush.
Yes, I can assure you that that will be one of the topics. I'm a little surprised that Karzai, President Karzai, has spoken out as strongly as he did. Although I understand his frustration, he's been very staunch. Backer of the American presence there, and I think we're going to. But I think these demonstrations and all have indicated to him that the situation needs to be addressed, and some changes made, perhaps.
And your book, it tells a story of how shortly after 9/11, you were sent in to lead up a small team of CIA officers to hook up with the Northern Alliance and to remove the Taliban. This, just predating this a little bit, the CIA had maintained relationships with the Northern Alliance, the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, and who I understood, and in your book you mentioned how much the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, to some extent created the Taliban and used their relationships with the Pashtun. That was their main concern. Now, weren't there other players as well influencing the Northern Alliance, the Russians, and to some extent even the Indian government doing a flanking movement on the Pakistanis?
Yes, you have to remember that in 1992, the U.S. government basically backed away from Afghanistan and said, you know, our mission, which was to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan, had been accomplished, and that we really weren't going to do much more than watch the Afghans, you know, settle their own problems. And
well, you mentioned that, by the way, Gary, in your book, where you talk to the CIA station chief, and he basically says, we're out of here, this government's going to fall, there's nothing to be done. I mean, isn't that, that's kind of a bit of a moral indictment there, isn't it? After having used these people to beat the Russians, we basically just walked away.
Well, I don't think we looked at it that way at that time. In other words, the Russians invaded, and the Afghans were fighting desperately to throw them out. We came in and helped the Afghans. Again, yes, we had our own agenda, which was to inflict pain and injury on the Russians. But we had a mutual a cause that we were fighting. Both sides had goals in mind, but we never lied to the Afghans. We always said, when the Russians are gone, we're gone. But in hindsight, it was a bad mistake.
Well, I got the impression from your book there that you weren't too happy with that notion that we were just going to walk away.
Well, no, because it did lead to civil war, and you could see that coming. Mm-hmm. Because the Pakistanis didn't walk away. The Pakistanis continued their support for the fundamentalist groups, Hekmatyar Gulbuddin and Sayyaf and these guys, and they encouraged the civil war. And so the civil war actually between those fundamentalist Pashtun groups and the Tajiks and Uzbeks in the north destroyed more of the country in some ways, or more of Kabul at least, than all the fighting did when the Russians were in the country.
And that allowed the Taliban to come up like a phoenix out of the ashes, right?
Absolutely, and as they began to grow, the ISI and the Pakistanis shifted their support from the failed Mujahideen fundamentalists like Hekmatyar and those guys, and shifted their support to the Taliban.
And just touching on other support for the Northern Alliance, the Russians were supporting him, and I think, is it true the Indians also were playing mischief there as well?
Well, the Indians got involved because, of course, their enemies are Pakistan, and they saw Pakistan opposing the Tajiks in the Northern Alliance, and so they began to provide monetary support annually to Massoud, and they actually opened up a hospital in Tajikistan that the Massoud's men could use. The Russians, surprisingly, after their history there, were welcomed as arms suppliers by the Northern Alliance because they didn't have any other sources, and the Russians played a role of selling arms and helicopters and other things to the Northern Alliance for cash.
But Massoud himself was you met with him, and I tell you, I mean, he was killed, what, 2 days before 9/11, and which turned out in retrospect to be a part of the overall plan, was it not?
Right. Massoud was the most charismatic and most brilliant general that developed in Afghanistan during that period. Very charismatic and a broad view of what Afghanistan should look like, in a peaceful situation. And he was the only force left by 2000 the year 2000 that was opposing the Taliban, and he was boxed in into his traditional homeland and with about 8 to 10,000 fighters, strong enough to hold the Taliban off, but not strong enough to defeat him. And our job, we had maintained contact, CIA had, with Massoud during that period, because we realized that without him there or his and his forces, there'd be no way for the United States to have any entry or any port place to enter into Afghanistan should we really need to get after bin Laden.
And on the Taliban side, I met with their ambassador at large, Rahmatullah, when he was traveling the country just about the time of the blowing up of the Buddhas. And there was some indication, and I, you mentioned in your book too, First In, An Insider's Account of How the CIA Spearheaded the War on Terror in Afghanistan, Gary Shon, you mentioned that there were contacts with the Taliban. Was there ever such a thing, I'm harkening back to Iran-Contra, was there ever such a thing as a moderate Taliban, and was there any possible cleavage there between the Taliban and bin Laden that could have been exploited?
Actually, I don't think there ever was a moderate Taliban leader or senior person. We did enter into negotiations with both State Department and CIA, jointly met with a couple of senior Taliban officials in the period like 1999 and 2000, trying to find some diplomatic solution to the bin Laden problem. They toyed with us. They played for time, but there was came away convinced there was never any serious negotiations that could have that they were willing to enter into, and they never had any intention of giving up bin Laden.
Now, were they? I mean, I never could understand, and I asked Rahmatullah any number of times about this. What was it about bin Laden that was so important to them that they'd risk their whole country?
Well, he had developed a mystique around him. He had been involved in the jihad, he more with his checkbook than personally risking himself back in those days. And his pronouncements against the West and his own philosophy fit pretty much well into what the Taliban leadership thought that they wanted to see in their own country and in the world at large.
So that Wahhabism is completely compatible with the kind of Islam that they wanted to practice.
Or absolutely,
that they do practice.
I think that there was that whole the Wahhabi philosophy tracks very much with what the what the Taliban wanted, and they looked at bin Laden as you know, some sort of a Robin Hood like figure who was opposing the United States, had actually inflicted damage on us in places, and was standing up for their what they viewed as what, you know, what Islam should be and what the future should look like.
Mm-hmm. Well, your experiences, which you recount in your book First In, An Insider's Account of How the CIA Spearheaded the War on Terror in Afghanistan, shows how, you know, a very small team of people brought about the destruction of this regime. And I guess the subtext, in a way, at the bureaucratic level, is that the CIA were the only people who were able to step up to the plate after 9/11 when the president was anxious to strike back at bin Laden, and that the Pentagon really didn't have a war plan for it, and they didn't even want to go into Afghanistan. It was like the graveyard of empires. And that this really improved George Tenet's stock in terms of his access and standing in the White House, and it really got under Rumsfeld's skin. And so when Iraq comes along, Rumsfeld makes sure that the State Department and the CIA are marginalized. So given that Henry Kissinger once described Rumsfeld as one of the most effective and vicious bureaucratic infighters, quite a compliment coming from Henry Kissinger. Give me a sense of that backstory in terms of, because we, you know, perhaps the audience don't realize that in Washington, the battles within Washington are often more fierce than the battles against the putative enemy that we have.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. The CIA, because we were prepared, we had since 1996 reestablished contact with the Northern Alliance. It was very easy for Mr. Tenet to go to the president on the 13th of September 2 days after the attacks and say, we can put a team on the ground in northern Afghanistan and get this fight started, whereas the military really didn't have a plan nor any resources in the region where they could easily deploy.
But by the way, the military in that same meeting on the 13th, they were talking about going into Iraq, weren't they? Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz.
Yeah, Wolfowitz. Their idea was let's bomb Iraq. Luckily, that didn't happen then, and we were able. The CIA was able to field the first team in there. It took a while for the Pentagon to work through what was going to happen, what their role would be. Would it be special operations officers, or were they going to try to put large conventional combat forces on the ground? And it came down to, because of the lack of prior planning and all, that they would go with it turned out to be 5th Special Forces Group and Green Berets. And so eventually we were joined by teams of Green Berets, and they were able to, really bring the fight down onto the Taliban with their laser targeting systems and all.
And I guess in a way, what was unique about that war was the use of money as a tactical weapon.
Well, exactly. One of the things, it's unique perhaps to Afghan culture, was that it, throughout the years of jihad and fighting against the Russians and all, one of the easiest ways to achieve a victory was to bribe opposition, your commanders, the sub-commanders across the lines, and bribe them to defect. And indeed, we used money that we brought in with us with the Northern Alliance, and they were able to actually convince some commanders on that they were facing to that it was the end was coming for them and they should change sides. And that was not looked on badly. They would change sides, and past sins would be forgiven, and they would be fighting as comrades then the next day.
And because the adage is you can't buy an Afghan's loyalty, but you can rent it.
That's something I've said quite a bit, and in that part of the world, and in it, that's not a bad thing.
Right.
You take care of your family and your tribe and your own personal things ahead of everything else.
And it was that kind of newly bought loyalty that was fielded at Tora Bora to some criticism, right?
Well, exactly, and the pattern had worked up till Tora Bora. We were dealing with commanders in other areas that would agree to work with us and indeed lived up to their bargain. What happened, we were dealing with some Pashtun commanders. Hezrat Ali was one of the major fellows there, who really, their men really supported the Taliban with a much deeper passion than we thought, and they admired bin Laden. And so while they took our money and stood ground, they let the leadership of both of the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban slip away.
And obviously, at that time also, after that, you set up a lot of teams to scour the countryside for him. But then those teams started to get cherry-picked for the upcoming Iraq war, right?
That's true. We had groups of we followed the pattern that had worked so effectively. A CIA team with elements of a special forces A team and or some other special operators, and then using local tribals that we could trust because we were on the ground with them and all. And we actually began to work pretty effectively on the Afghan side of the border. But by March of 2002. Drawdowns started happening from those groups of special forces guys. They were pulled back to regroup for Iraq, and the demands of staffing for on the CIA side to get ready for Iraq were tremendous, and it became very difficult for us to staff the outposts and these little teams that we had out in the countryside. And in fact, the numbers went from 6 guys, 7 guys in one place down to 2 or 3 maybe at the most. It was very difficult.
So all the institutional memory went out the window, too. I mean,
a lot of it, yes. Yeah. And it was, they were looking for the best guys to go to Iraq, and so then we were facing the problem of that bin Laden was in Pakistan, and while the Pakistanis were living up to their pledge to help us in their cities. But they were very reluctant to go into the tribal areas, and so we were had reduced capabilities on the Afghan side and limited cooperation from the PACs on the immediate other side of the border. And so bin Laden has been able to hide out effectively since then.
And do you think the Pakistanis really want to capture him, given the likelihood of an enormous, it's a pretty tenuous hold that it seems that Musharraf has vis-a-vis the fundamentalists, and not that they'd need any excuses to take to the street, but, my feeling would be that if they ever caught him, they wouldn't catch him alive. I mean, there's a history there, isn't there, with ISI and...
Exactly. Well, Musharraf finds himself between a rock and a very hard place. He's got his own militants that he had organized, that the Pakistanis had organized to fight in Kashmir against the Indian occupation there.
People, by the way, are threatening now. They're threatening the Pakistani military, the Punjabi officers.
Exactly.
Because they're mad as hell that they're making a deal with India.
Exactly. And Musharraf is trying to improve relations, and he's backed away from support of the Kashmiri militancy. And then those guys hiding out in the cities who have already tried to kill Musharraf several times all became friends with the al-Qaeda during the years when they were training in the camps in Afghanistan, training together. And so he faces a really tough situation. And if he really goes after bin Laden publicly and openly and kills him or hands him over to us, there will be a huge backlash there. So the problem is to come up with some formula that will allow him the ability to move against bin Laden without endangering his own stability. And I don't know if we're going to be able to achieve that. I'm certainly hopeful, but that we're going to give it a good shot, because this is the summer to do it. This is the time now to get after him.
And let's remind the audience again, if I may, I'm speaking with Gary Schoen, who's the author of First In, an insider's account of how the CIA spearheaded the war on terror in Afghanistan. And Gary, it's often said, the White House has referred often to the Iraq War as a catastrophic success, explaining why they were not prepared for the aftermath of the war. Although we know, again, going back to the bureaucratic infighting that we were talking about earlier, that the State Department got marginalized and the CIA got marginalized, and all of the so-called evidence for this war was they avoided sending it through the normal CIA channels like Curveball and the Niger documents and other things that we used as justification for this war, both in the President's State of the Union and in Colin Powell's address to the UN. So, but in a way, let me just run this by you. Perhaps this is my theory, but it seems to me that in what may have happened there was that Afghanistan was a catastrophic success, that the Taliban and all of those foreign fighters were so thoroughly defeated, except for bin Laden escaping, that the White House and the Pentagon wanted a real war. I mean, of course, from the very beginning, as you mentioned earlier, on 2 days after 9/11, they were talking about bombing Iraq. So what's your feeling about, is there any cause and effect there?
Well, I think that your analysis is probably absolutely correct. Well, we had defeated the Taliban and the al-Qaeda in Afghanistan handily. I mean, there's still elements that are over hiding in Pakistan that pose threats. But it was easy to say, and people still say today in the administration, and that we've marginalized bin Laden, and he's much less of a threat than he was, and so we should look elsewhere and focus on Iraq. Unfortunately, I don't think Iraq was a problem in the fight on terrorism prior to our invasion. It's become a magnet and a rallying point for young Islamic radicals who want to take on America. And so I think now we do have a real problem, and there is a war on terror aspect to this whole mess in Iraq. But I think there was the feeling that, well, we've done so well in Afghanistan, we can kind of put that into a second tier of interest and move on and take on some of the other issues that the administration wanted to take on.
But it's not as if, at least rhetorically, we're ending it there, because there's sort of rumors of war, if you will, vis-a-vis Iran. So it's not as though it seems like we've got our hands full in Iraq, but nevertheless, that hasn't stopped us from doing a little bit of saber rattling vis-a-vis Iran.
Well, I think Iran has always since the Khomeini revolution started in 79, we've always had this feeling we're going to have to one day deal with Iran. The Syrians are proving to be ineffective. They're allowing their country to be used as a sanctuary for insurgents who are coming into Iraq to fight us. So you've also got the administration, and I think, looking at Syria seriously. So there's a couple of other areas. I mean, not only is attention being shifted from, has shifted from Afghanistan to some extent, but it's also shifting over into other areas, Syria, Iran, of course, in North Korea remains
But Syria is just so rotten, and that regime is so unpopular, both within the country itself and in the region, particularly after the killing of Hariri. And I'll be talking about that next week. But on the other hand, Iran is a different matter. Iran's the only country that seems to have benefited so far from our incursion into Iraq. That's taking them on is nothing. That would be disastrous, would it not? If the Iraq situation isn't bad enough, I mean.
Well, there has to be some serious thought about how to approach the Iranians, because they now have this view of the world that the United States, all of these things. The invasion of Iraq defeat of the Taliban in Afghanistan, it's all aimed at Iran eventually. The conspiracy theory there is so strong that all of these maneuvers are simply the U.S. positioning itself to take on Iran and remove the mullahs from power, that we're going to have to be very, very careful. The Iranians are a much tougher group to take on, as they proved in that 8-year war with Iraq.
I guess in closing, I don't wish to be inflammatory, but does this government know what they're doing, or are they winging it? Or, I mean, they've never been able to give us a straight answer of why they went into Iraq. They may get lucky because the dominoes are falling all over the place with Syria and perhaps, elections in Egypt as well. But I just wonder at the end of the day whether, I take people like Scowcroft seriously and their warnings, and they seem to have been completely ignored.
I agree with you. I think that this is, we're moving forward in an area here. As you say, dominoes are ready to fall, like this with the Syrians or whatever. But what the consequences of that? If the Syrian government goes, what comes after that? And how do we influence that? And what do we end up with another kind of a civil war situation there? And Lord, we better be very, very careful with as we move forward with dealing with Iran, because military saber rattling isn't going to work with them.
I thank you very much for joining us, Gary Sharon, and for your new book, First In, An Insider's Account of How the CIA Spearheaded the War on Terror in Afghanistan.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Gary Sharon, who is the author of a new book, First In, An Insider's Account of How the CIA Spearheaded the War on Terrorism in Afghanistan. He was a CIA officer for 35 years, and he was his honors include the Intelligence Cross, the highest award given by the CIA. I thank the engineer, Jazz Shepard, and the producer, Lewis Vandenberg, assistant producers, Carol Coote and Rusty Wynn.